Welcome to the Out of Space podcast, hosted by me, Kathy Lomax, featuring artists from Across Spaces Studios in conversation with writers, critics and art professionals, offering a closer look into what happens behind closed studio doors. Over the next 8 episodes, we will be exploring the theme of care from multiple viewpoints, ranging from artists and parenthood to caring about the community and about the work itself. This series was recorded remotely in order to adhere to social distancing rules, and there may be variations in sound quality. Out of Space, a podcast by Space Studios. Today's episode from Out of Space's Care series is called The Message. In particular, I want to examine to what extent we should exercise care when making and exhibiting work that has controversial or provocative content. Yoko Ono said that controversy is part of the nature of art and creativity. So should we worry if audiences are offended by our work? And how do we make sure that our message is not misinterpreted? To examine this thorny subject, I'm delighted to be joined by two artists, Harold Offay and Rhiannon Salisbury. So hello, both of you. Thanks for being here. Harold Offay lives and works in Cambridge and London. He's exhibited widely, including at Tate Britain and Tate Modern, South London Gallery, Turf Projects, Wising Art Centre, Studio Museum Harlem and Art Tower Mito. Harold is a reader in fine art at Leeds Beckett University and a tutor at the Royal College of Art. In 2019, he was a recipient of the Paul Hamlin Foundation Award for Artists, the largest award of its kind in the UK. Upcoming commissions include a new video work exploring the redemptive power of joy through social dance for On Happiness at the Wellcome Collection, and he'll be taking part in Untitled, Art on the Conditions of Our Time, a major exhibition of British artists of African descent at Kettle's Yard. On to Rhiannon Salisbury. She lives and works in London and has a studio at Space's Sarah Lane Studios in Hoxton. She graduated from the Terps Banana Studio Painting Programme in 2018, having previously completed an MA in Fine Art at Chelsea College of Art. Her recent solo exhibitions include Habitual Submission at Delphian Gallery, London in 2019, the Derbyshire Prize for Emerging Artists at Derbyshire Limited with Terps Banana in London in 2018, and Accessorised with a Tiger at Arusha Gallery, Edinburgh in 2018. Rhiannon's recent achievements include winning the Derbyshire Prize for Emerging Art, being awarded the John Hoyland Scholarship, and being selected to undertake a residency and exhibition in Guadalajara, Mexico. Did I get that right?
Guadalajara, yeah.
Guadalajara. I knew I'd get that wrong. So I'd just like to start off by finding out a bit more about both of your work. So maybe I can start with Harold and if you could just tell us a bit more about your practice and some of the themes that your work explores, that would be great.
Yeah, sure. It's great to be here. Thank you for the invitation. Great to be in conversation. I guess my work, it sort of manifests itself in many different forms, but I think a through line is an engagement with performance and maybe performance as a kind of research tool for posing and exploring questions. I guess throughout my practice, I've been really interested in histories and social contexts, and thinking about how one might use the body and aspects of performance to engage with historical kind of context. So, yeah, I mean, examples of sort of projects really, I did a project in 2019 with Turf Projects in Croydon, which involved working with the Croydon Museum and responding to 5 objects, which were then sort of activated through kind of collaborations with artists from Croydon College, people within the community. What kind that of was objects? A meeting. Oh God, you don't want to get me started. This is like hellish enough trying to succinctly sort of like.
Okay,
that,
okay.
Because often it's so kind of like contextual, the practice, and very situational. But I mean, it was a range of things from like a 1993 Croydon Pride t-shirt to a book by a late Victorian sexologist and also eugenicist called Havelock Ellis. I'll stop there because,
okay,
everything a has a story.
Yeah.
And
okay, that sounds really fascinating. That's, such a... lots to think about. So, Rhiannon, can you do the same, really? Tell us a bit about your practice and the themes.
Yes. Hi, I'm Rhiannon. I've been thinking, am I an artist or a painter, and what's the difference? But I think I've come to the conclusion that I'm a painter. And so I make paintings that are, they have two sides of them. Like they have one side which is almost therapeutic, like I make them as a way to process what's going on with me at that moment in time. And then I guess the other side is political, in the sense that they're a response to what I consider like injustices in the system or problems that I'm confronted with or have had an experience of. So the body of work that I guess you're familiar with would be that I've done a lot of paintings of women derived from advertising images. And these are sort of intended to challenge like a capitalist machine, or like this mass media that is omnipresent all around us, that like in my eyes, and I'm sure like a lot of other people's eyes, has a dystopian quality.
And the paint itself is quite particular. The application of the paint, is it quite impasto, or how would you describe
it? They're really thick. So it's almost sort of like swirls of paint that could turn into mud. So I use very synthetic colours, like you would see like in the magazine or on a screen, quite deliberately. But then there are areas where it just threatens to totally disintegrate because they've all mushed into each other and become something quite grotesque and disgusting. So it's like this balance of like pop and like really bright, like gem-like stuff that will catch your eye like a magpie, and then just really murky pools in the mix with that too.
That's really that's a really good description. I can really picture that now, even though I do know what they look like. It's nice. So I guess maybe we can get started by just thinking about this is for both of you really, has your work ever been misinterpreted? And is it important to consider how your work is perceived? I know that's kind of like a rather broad, but I don't know. What do you think, Harold? Maybe could start with you.
Misinterpreted. It's interesting, isn't it? I mean, sort of. I guess that sort of suggests that you know, as an artist or an author, you might think about the work in one way, and then, you know, there's a sense in which there's a kind of sort of wrong way. I guess it's more about, I mean, obviously people have interpreted things that I've done in many different ways. But, you know, I think there have been instances where people have felt the work is maybe perpetuating like certain ideas or stereotypes that are maybe, you know, were sort of counter to the way that I wanted the work to operate in. But in a sense, I think, you know, it's not necessarily something that I particularly can complain about. I mean, I think there might be, I was just thinking about this question actually, there might be specific instances where your work is, you know, used to support an argument or used to support a position that is very counter, that you feel is ethically problematic or kind of morally dubious. And I think in those, I haven't had those kind of situations, but I imagine those to be the ones that I, would find challenging. I think where it's a question of kind of interpretation and reading, I think, I make work to stimulate discourse. So one can't really complain when somebody, decides to kind of like engage with it in a particular way. But I think there is a kind of line, the idea that the work might be used to support, like an agenda that I deeply find immoral, some kind of exploitation or like, some kind of sexism or racism. I mean, I would challenge that, I think,
That's so interesting, that thing about how it, your work could be, somebody could use it to say the kind of opposite of what you're thinking, because I remember this really specific incident when I was actually in Leeds doing a talk when you were there, Harold, and one of the students said to me, isn't, because I often make work using images from fashion and advertising and film, and so images of women, and they said, isn't your work just supporting the kind of the status quo and showing these passive images of women? And I was really taken aback because I hadn't really prepared for it, I guess, but it's something I've thought about ever since. So it's really good to get those challenging thoughts and people to say those things, I think, sometimes, isn't it? Because it does, like you say, of course, when you make work, you don't know what people are going to think about it. And I've been asked before as well to write about what my work is about and what people, are meant to get from it for certain, publications and things. And I'm like, oh, I can't do that because I don't really know what people are going to get from it exactly. I can only say what I was thinking about when I made it. That's really interesting. Rhiannon, what do you think about that? Has your
I think been... when you were just talking, Kathy, about like being confronted with your work potentially like having the opposite impact of the one you thought it would, I came up against this idea in the sense that I say my work is against the capitalist machine and like trying to challenge that, and yet I'm making luxury items. So like the act of making a painting that's going to be bought by someone who can afford the privilege of purchasing that art, that's a really awkward like position or junction to be at as well. And like, they're interesting questions. Like, for me, I used to get very frustrated or insecure when people thought that I was intending to solely make a picture of a beautiful woman, and I'd somewhat, like, missed the mark because she wasn't quite pretty enough. But the older I get, the less important it is for me to be able to tell someone else what to think about my work. Like, I don't know how important it is for someone to interpret a message that I want them to interpret. Like, it's more, I get a lot of joy from people like being engaged with my work. I don't know if it's necessarily in my place to tell them what it means.
And so, Do you think your work's provocative? Would you ideally want it to be provocative? Is that a good place to be? Harold, what do you think? And Rhiannon, both of you.
Yeah, I don't know if Rhiannon wants to...
I think my mind has changed over time with that, and it continues to change. Like, with certain bodies of work, I've definitely had the intention that they would be provocative, and that's been important to me. Like, my last solo show was intended as something provocative, and I wanted people to be like challenged by it or to have questions raised from interacting with it around the role of women in society and advertising. Going forward, I don't know if I will always have that intention. That's not the sole purpose of why I make work. Every time I come, like, it kind of depends on the body of work if that makes sense.
Yeah. So Harold, I'm thinking, I've got in my head the picture of you doing the Grace Jones album cover, performing the Grace Jones album cover. Mm. And I don't know if that's provocative exactly, but there's something about it. I guess it's maybe going into a different area as well, which is I was thinking about humour and satire, sort of touching on that. But do you want your work to be provocative? Is that important?
It's a really good question. I think it's maybe changed for me over the years. In that, yeah, I would think about the work. How would it engage, challenge, provoke, allow people to kind of sort of question? But I find personally that actually, what I really mean is, like, does it provoke me, as opposed to thinking about an external audience? Because it's quite difficult to kind of, kind of quantify or imagine the impact on the work on one person or one constituent group over the other. And it's interesting you bring up the kind of Grace Jones kind of covers piece, because I think that's one of the least provoking works for me, because for people who don't know, it's me, I'm reenacting Grace Jones's Eyed and Life album cover, where she's doing this arabesque one leg pose and she's like naked and oiled. It's all mostly in profile, just to describe for people who don't know. But I felt really reticent about it, because it's like, in performance, it's such a cliche to be naked. It's just like, you know. So, and I've, I mean, it's not something I have an issue with, nudity, but I've been in so many performance live art situations where, you know, like the audience is groaning. It's like, oh, another nude. Oh, somebody's running around. So for me, that was what I was really scared about. Was like, oh my God, I'm just doing that live art thing of like, here's my naked body, you know, the essence of like, of rawness and honesty. So it's about really embracing that kind of cliche. I didn't, you know, I mean, obviously some people will find maybe nudity provocative or maybe my nude body provocative, but yeah, I mean, I think the way I think about work now is kind of often around, trying to push myself into sort of situations or engaging with material that is, I find, provoking. And, I think I'm generally more conservative than I would admit to. So it's kind of like, so, I mean, that's why I've sort of stopped like this, like, you know, trying specifically to kind of target, you know, in a sort of directed way. But I hope people will engage with the work. And if part of that means that it's provocative, then I think that's good, potentially, you know.
I guess working in performance, you have that direct connection with an audience, so you can kind of be aware at the source, as it were, of something maybe about the effect it's having on people, which you don't get obviously when you're making a painting, unless you were doing some kind of live painting making kind of thing, which that sounds terrifying to me.
I've seen it.
So you've seen it, yeah. Watching paint dry, very, very exciting.
No, there's an amazing artist called David Hoyle, who's like an amazing drag, sort of, well, I don't necessarily drag, but just an amazing performance artist. And yeah, he does a lot of like live painting, and it's amazing. It's just really something.
Is it like the, this is probably a bit too... far in the distant past for most people. Is it like the Rolf Harris painting? I know, bad name as well.
I've not heard that name mentioned in a long time.
I used to love those paintings he did on his show when he was like, "Do you know what it's going to be yet?"
Yeah. With the wobble board, yeah.
Exactly.
Ralph's Cartoon Club. Anyway, it's great. I guess it's like that. There's a kind of sort of banter. He has an interaction with like the audience. I mean, it's kind of a bit like stand up as well in terms of he's sort of really wit. But then also you see this work. It's, you know, it's very loose and thrown around. But it's also there's a kind of magic to that as a kind of sort of spectacle. And there's a really amazing history of like performance and painting and mark making. Over the years, you know, if we look across, you know, the history, there's a kind of interesting kind of relationship, you know.
Yeah, I guess there's that amazing film of Jackson Pollock, isn't there, making paintings, and Picasso, I seem to remember. And I think it is a fascination that people have with how was this thing made. So I can imagine, just personally, the idea of anybody watching me paint just makes me feel really uncomfortable. I feel like it's this private act that I have to lock myself away in the studio and take part in. So the body, I guess this brings us on quite naturally to the idea of the body and thinking maybe beyond your own practices. Do you think that using kind of provocative, like naked, pictures of naked bodies can be a way of developing your practice legitimately, like a way of getting interest? Is it a legitimate strategy to go down these areas? Because I guess if we were making really dull work, then nobody would be interested. So you do need an element of something to kind of get it all started, the career as an artist.
Yeah, I think also when you learn to paint and draw, you learn from the body. Like in a traditional schooling, you would learn how to draw and paint from life. And like I did that with my practice, and it was quite fundamental. And then you study like the history of art, and it's all like there's so many bodies in that. So I like, it is legitimate. I think we all, like, I feel very disembodied most of the time, and when making images of bodies, it's almost a way of like connection. And I think my figures are very awkward, and that was something I thought against in my work. Until I realised that's its strength, is this kind of awkwardness about the paint and about the bodies within it. Yes, like, it can be really sensationalist. Yeah. Like, people just paint a naked body to draw attention, and I have been aware that, you know, posts of mine with naked bodies get more attention than posts which don't, or like there's just, it is almost like a kind of surefire way to get some attention, which, you know, could be used or misconstrued as a gimmick in the wrong hands or by certain people, but I don't think that means it's not a valid kind of route in for exploration or expression.
That's really interesting. You know, of course, the naked body is there in art history as Harold was saying, really, as kind of the most basic thing. You know, you were saying in performance, the naked body is kind of passé almost, and the same in painting and drawing, isn't it? So, yeah. So there's nothing new there, but I guess it's just the way it might be presented, or maybe it's always, there's always a new way of showing the body, the naked body, doing something that will be controversial for different times. I don't know. I know that at Transition Gallery, ages ago now, when we first opened, we had a show that we called Girl on Girl, because it was female artists, and then we just got all this press because and all these hits on the website because people thought it was some kind of sex thing. And I was like, oh, this is really cool. We can get, like, you know, all these people watching what we're doing because they think it's something which it isn't, because it wasn't really that exciting. And yeah, and then it just kind of got me starting about that. But also, I was also thinking about an artist called Stella Vine that we used to show, who did on occasion really court that kind of controversial subject matter. She did a Sylvia Plath's gas oven was one piece she did, where she painted on an oven and things like that. And Princess Diana kind of crying and blood coming out of her mouth and stuff because she'd just been attacked or something. I don't know. She would just love stuff that was very on the edge of some kind of media sensation, I think. And it did get her lots of attention and kind of did do something for her career, but maybe there ultimately wasn't much more behind those particular works. They were just a sort of surface enactment with that. So I guess that can be a problem. Do you think that things should be off limits in an artwork? Should there be things? Oh. No, that's a bit of a broad question, isn't it?
Yeah. Huge kind of sort of moral. Yes, I think there should be. I think there are certain things, ethical boundaries and considerations. I think, you know, deliberate cruelty to, like, animals or people, I think is kind of off limit. I think, violence, anything unconsensual is off limits. I mean, I think in a way, really, it's just like a kind of question of freedom, isn't it? There's a sort of like romanticized cliche of like artistic freedom, or like, you know, the freedom to voice your opinions. It's like, actually, we live in societies where there are constraints on freedoms, necessary ones that sort of protect us. And while censorship is problematic and abhorrent, I think it's also important, I think, to kind of recognise those and also re-question and revisit those moral and ethical boundaries that sort of help to kind of regulate that. And I personally don't see art, I know some people might see art as being somehow apart or removed from culture and society, but I actually think it's completely embedded, and therefore, you know, the things that sort of inform the way that you might behave and interact in society, I think, you know, should inform the way that we kind of behave. I mean, but that's not to say that, you know, artists are often, you know, like you said, provocateurs or challenging or testing the boundaries of that and sort of, you know, pushing up against those moral rules and regulations. And I think that's also part of the conversation. I'm not saying that that's, you know, that's also how we've got here, is that, you know, artists in previous generations have really tested some of those moral boundaries and values. So I also don't view it as a kind of fixed thing, you know, and I think artists have a genuine contribution to kind of make, but it's something that is, you know, is contested, and I think is continually being reassessed and developed. Yeah,
I think Harold explained that so well, like, because I think it is kind of fluid. There's some works that I've seen that have really disgusted me and made me feel ill. And like, these are sort of like, you know, if I see works with like swastikas in them and I'm like, this is just to get attention. There's no real depth to this work. You've just used this like iconography to be shocking. It really angers me. But I think putting restrictions on what people are allowed to make is so dangerous as well. And like, you know, where art does have a social purpose, we should be striving as artists to create like a better world. Like, I do believe there's like a moral responsibility of like an artist, but of anyone really, to like try and promote like values of equality, which just aren't like current. Like, maybe we're making steps in the right direction and not all art has to be political, but I think if you're putting something into a public space, there should be like some social conscience or ethical conscience behind that, and you have to be respectful of other cultures and like not take kind of token signs just for effect. Like, you know, I think if you're using things with like grave significance, you should be like aware and appropriate with that. But yeah, if you start saying you're not allowed to make work in this vein, like that, I think that's equally really dangerous. So I think it's, yeah, like how Harold described it, I think there's a lot of thought behind that.
Yeah, it's a complex relationship, isn't it, I guess. I mean, I'm not absolutely sure that work should have a good moral purpose. I kind of think often it work reflects back the society at the time it was made. So there's a kind of reflective documentary element to it maybe as well. But yeah, the idea of cruelty to animals in work is something that just seems, which is, I guess, is very kind of British, a very British thing, is just above all else is terrible. I just saw the Matthew Barney film at the Hayward Gallery, and it's about a wolf hunt, and a wolf gets killed in it. Although there's a big message which says the wolf wasn't actually killed, it was like a stunt wolf or something, and all this kind of stuff. But I was just like, oh my God, I can't watch this. I don't want to watch a film about a wolf getting killed. This is horrible. So there are things, I suppose, for all of us that are just the thing that we don't want to see and is just beyond the pale. But this makes me think about, all of this makes me think about social media and the censorship that is encountered on Instagram, for instance, whereby they have certain rules that they bring into play if they decide an image is, I don't even know what they are actually, but I'm guessing nudity and things like that are part of it, then they will take people's accounts down. And I just read something about a student at the RCA whose Instagram account was disabled, and they were really upset because they wanted to, you know, promote their latest work and they couldn't, and they weren't told why it was taken down. So that kind of censorship, Instagram seems to have such a power at the moment over the kind of work that is successful, that's seen as successful. I think so many artists use it, and it's hard not to be swayed a little bit by things that are really popular. I'll put one painting up and hardly anybody will be interested, and another one will get hundreds of likes, and you're like, oh, well, that's obviously what I should be doing. So there's this sort of weird way that it's leading what we do, and it's telling us we can't do certain things. Do you both use Instagram? I think you do, don't you? Yeah, and any thoughts on that?
I think with the censorship thing, I've found that I have had things removed, mainly when I'm posting other people's work. So it's like you said, like I was trying to post a photo that I'd taken last week at Collective Ending Show of Natalia Gonzalez's work, where it's very beautiful, like Renaissance style painting of a female body. And I just couldn't post it. And then my account was disabled for 2 days. And I found that very frustrating. And I think as a platform, I can't totally slag it off, because it's been really useful for my practice in terms of like I've connected with an audience outside of the system I would have had access to otherwise. And that has like massively benefited me and my potential to become a full-time artist. But equally, I do find it really frustrating and limiting. And I'm looking forward to the next phase of social media and what that might be. And like as a platform, it is kind of good and bad in equal measures for me. I think there's something better that will come along.
That hasn't been invented yet. The better thing.
Hopefully.
And Harold, are you much of a user of social media?
Very idiosyncratically, not in a kind of sort of dedicated, strategized way that that you know many of my peers are. You know, I tend to sort of dump things and then just don't post for ages, which is apparently one of the worst things you can do. You're meant to sort of be regularly engaging an audience. I mean, the censorship thing is kind of, I mean, to me, sort of Instagram, you know, which is Facebook, you know, is indicative of kind of this weird erasure of like, well, not even erasure, actually. It's the kind of sort of misreading of public privates. You know, these are all private companies, you know, so they, you know, but they seem to function like public space. So I think there's a kind of seduction of like, oh, this is a public forum, and in the way that, you know, we think about the freedoms of that. It's a bit like housing developments that you see springing up all over the UK where, you know, they have like plazas that are kind of like public space, but actually you try and take a photograph and a security guard comes out and says, no, it's a private space, you know. So I think for me that's problematic, I think, is that lack of transparency sometimes in that. But it's obviously a deliberate sort of ploy that the platforms are kind of using, you know. And I mean, not, I don't want to pivot to talking about Donald Trump, but it's interesting that they...
Please do.
Well, no, just in the sense that, you know, I think, you know, Twitter and Facebook and Instagram, it's interesting, you know, they espouse a kind of spirit of kind of sort of free speech. And then there's, you know, then somebody crosses the line and then it's shut down, which I think they rightly should do. But I think my issue is they could have done that earlier. But ultimately, it's this thing where we think it's like a kind of public space, but actually they are private companies. They are actually authoring and editing material. And I just wish there was a bit more transparency in relation to that. But I do agree with what Rhiannon said. It's like a huge window. It's a huge platform for people to kind of reach out and engage audiences and kind of connect. And but I also kind of think about like, sort of, I was trying to think about like the social media, internet, you know, like the Industrial Revolution, you know. And I think we're at that point in, sorry, I'm a bit of a history geek, we're at that point where, you know, at the beginning it was like very deregulated, you know, in the way that sort of like the early part of the Industrial Revolution was just really crazy and inventors coming up with things. And then in the sort of mid to late 19th century, I think I was just making that analogy with, yeah, the Industrial Revolution, like the cycle. So at the beginning you get all the crazy inventors and it's really exciting, and then you get kind of the sort of coalescing of capital, you get the barons that take over. So whether that's, you know, people like Carnegie in the 19th century that owned all the railways and steel, and, you know, they're like the Zuckerbergs and the Bezoses and all those people.
Yeah.
Now, it's actually what happens next, you know, in terms of the need for the government to regulate these people now that are, you know, have more wealth and power than some nation states. That's the next phase, you know, but I think, who knows how long that will be?
I always find it so interesting. Sorry, Rhiannon. I just find it really interesting the way certain social media platforms have become popular amongst certain groups of people. So I think artists tend to favour Instagram at the moment, visual artists. The other group that I'm kind of part of is film academics, because I'm studying film at the moment, and they just do Twitter. They don't really do Instagram at all. So it's a completely different set of people using a different platform. And Facebook, I guess, is now families, isn't it? It's sort of evolved from younger people using it, and the demographic has got much older, and kind of families reconnecting and things. So that's kind of fascinating in that development of things, the way things always develop, like as you're saying with the Industrial Revolution. But I interrupted you, Rhiannon, sorry.
No, I was just thinking about what Harold was saying, and I think that's actually a really cool analogy, because it does feel like Instagram and Facebook or whatever, they've got to a really stale point where it is really just like consumerable, or like, I don't know, there's no, even though they're trying with all the reels now to imitate TikTok and stuff, like it just feels like a very dead formula that's, that there's no excitement or experimentation within it. And it is time for something new. I don't know if you guys are familiar with Clubhouse, and I'm not like a social media groupie or anything, but no. I've just got on that this week, and I think that's already on its way out potentially, but this is a forum which isn't visual, it's like chat rooms, and that's been quite interesting, because I've had some really interesting conversations where like you just join chats you're interested in, and for example, like the last couple of weeks there's been a lot of rooms where people from Palestine and Israel have both been together expressing their points of view to one another in a kind of, I don't know, like a way I would never have had access to listen to those conversations anywhere else, and they're trying to like work out dialogues with each other that are peaceful and cooperative and expressing both sides of view from like ordinary people, like away from the politics. And that's quite a fresh use of social media, that it can enable like a space where those conversations can take place. And you know, we're in a world where social media is going to continue to thrive and evolve, like that's here to stay now, so it's just how we take that into a space that isn't, like you were kind of talking about, private, although they are all private companies. It's like, how can we make this something that is like a vehicle for kind of positive change in some way, and to like move things forward. But yeah, I just like, it's going to be really interesting to see where it all goes, I think.
Yeah, I mean, it is fascinating. It's kind of reminds me a little bit of the somebody told me once about the market for Barbie dolls. When they came out, they were aimed at teenagers, and teenagers bought them. And then the teenagers' younger sisters kind of wanted, saw them and aspired to them, and they took them and started playing with them. So the teenagers was like, oh, I'm not playing with Barbie anymore, that's for kids. And then the even younger children took them, and now it's kind of like 3-year-olds or 4-year-olds that have Barbies, and anybody older than that would just think they were for babies. So I think everything kind of goes through this development, doesn't it, where it gets a bit dumber and dumber, maybe. Oh. And yeah, just isn't. Because in the early days of Twitter and Instagram even, Twitter was almost like this kind of utopian society where, you know, it was amazing. You could listen to what your favourite politician or famous person really thought about something. They could speak to you and, you know, that kind of thing. And it was all great. And then, obviously, all sorts of other stuff has happened since, culminating in Donald Trump. So, yeah, I would really like to talk more about humour and satire and how that comes into play, because I feel like that is something which has some kind of connection to both of your work anyway, and if you think that's an important way of putting across a message, and maybe to not to disguise a deeper topic, but a way of making some, like a kind of hook, I guess, of making something accessible and interesting, and then, you know, having more to say about it. Yeah, so any thoughts?
I think that a lot of people outside of the arts are scared of having an opinion about art. And I think that humour or satire can be a way to dispel that anxiety. So if you have a joke or something that makes you laugh, like you feel like you're connected to it and like you're part of that conversation, and suddenly you're not excluded from it anymore. So in that way, I think it is a good hook or a good way in to art potentially.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a really good way of putting it, definitely. I think it's, for me, a very good strategy of trying to engage people. There's that sense in which I think how satire operates on multiple levels, I think, is really interesting. In the A, it can engage with, like, the idea of humour and pleasure and conviviality that sort of comes with that idea of kind of, you know, finding something humorous or laughing at something, but also, you know, the critique, the underlying critique, or analysis or reflection on a particular kind of subject. So for me, as a kind of strategy, it's enabling, and I think in the way that Rhiannon was sort of saying about audiences that are very intimidated by art, like, sometimes I feel like I'm sort of fighting against how art with a capital A kind of sort of really gets in the way, you know, because I think so many people have, you know, feel very excluded from it, feel that it's exclusive or it's sort of outside of their, you know, their own experience or their ability to kind of engage with. Something I'm very passionate about is, like, you know, art in schools. I feel like a lot of people have been really scarred by their experiences in school, like, you know, secondary school, particularly. Primary school, not so much, but it's... So, I mean, so I'm really actively engaged in this idea of how do we... You know, I feel like as an artist, sometimes you have to find ways of getting past people's perception of the art to actually get to the work, because actually, you know, I feel like when people really just engage with the work and where they're not worried about, oh, well, it's, you know, it's in this quite intimidating gallery and I should know what it means. I should, you know, and where they just, you know, simply engage with it. They look at it, they take their time. They're not worrying about whether they should like it or whether they know completely everything about the kind of history. I mean, all the reasons that we're artists, you know, like, it's kind of, I find it a little bit frustrating. And for me, kind of humour is like a good way because of, like I said, because of the way it operates on so many levels of allowing people into the work in a particular way. I mean, there are other strategies that also work that I've seen, you know, it's not the only one, but
no, yeah. But whose fault is it that, do you think, that there is this perception of art as this thing that's very difficult and serious and, you know, not for me kind of thing? I mean, I think there's a certain thing about taste at play whereby people are very worried about their own taste levels, and they think that bringing in humour again, they're worried they might be laughed at if they like the wrong thing. If they hang the wrong painting on the wall, then people are going to be going, oh my God, look at that. They thought it was art and it's terrible. So there's something here about, I think, people are worried about being judged, and yeah, they can't just look at it. And, you know, it doesn't, there are no ways that you should, as we've kind of discussed, that you have to think about work. It really is to be looked at, isn't it? Yeah, go ahead.
Well, I'm only, because I'm going to go off on another historical kind of rant, but I do have a particular take on this, which I think is a historical, from a historical position. And I think we've got to be quite specific. I think this is a quite British approach, like, in terms of this idea of kind of taste. But also, I think what underlies that is our relationship to images. And I think about, for example, if we just take Europe, there's a very definite split, which comes along with, I think, the difference between a kind of a Protestant approach to perhaps a kind of Catholic approach. You know, if we think about the split, the kind of schism, it happens around images, right? So... You know, Protestantism is about the text, the word, and it promotes the word, and it's completely distrustful of images. And I think you really see that within the kind of British approach to image making. It's very distrustful. What we value most is our literature. Shakespeare, Dickens, Austin. We really value text. And I think that is to do with this kind of inbuilt psychology that comes down from a kind of Protestant skepticism of images, you know, that whitewashing of, you know, Henry VIII, of kind of all the abbeys, the sort of scratching out of images as idolatrous. And I think that carries across in the culture, partly in the elite culture as well, and in this idea of kind of sort of, in the, you just see in the public discourse that there is an inherent skepticism of images. It's like, well, it's taking the piss, right, isn't it? I mean, that's how it articulates itself now. But I think it goes back to this idea of a distrust of image making, which, you know, like, you, I don't really see in Italy or Spain. I think there's a, people will just, they're used to images. They're engaging with images. I mean, I know I'm partly generalising massively. And obviously there are, you know, within those countries, there are huge kind of taste differences. And but I just think at that level of kind of enculturation, I think for me, there's something about the legacy of those histories that still kind of play out.
That's really interesting. And I've never thought about it. I think you should write a book about it, Harold. But yeah, I think I can see what you're saying and how it could be true. I think also the art market has had a lot, like a massive role to play in people's perceptions of not being able to engage with art or not knowing enough about it too, obviously, because they want you to think that it's a secret and they've got the keys to the secret. And, you know, if you trust them, like, you can buy good taste, like, but you have to be able to afford it, and it's an elite thing. And I think there's like a lot of snobbery around what's good art or bad art. And it's just, it's, you know, it's a way to make it more expensive, or, you know, it's intended, isn't it? It's like a marketing thing.
Yeah, the kind of separation of high and low culture, and this is good and this is bad. I mean, I personally love low culture best of everything. And so many interesting things that you were both saying there, I think, and lots of stuff that we could follow up on.
I blame Greenberg.
It's all Greenberg, his... oh. Okay. Go ahead.
I actually, just thinking about what you were saying about literature versus image making, like, I went to university and studied literature because I thought it was more acceptable than studying image making. You know, like, it took me 10 years to actually go and study art full time because I thought, yeah, like, there was more cultural value or like intellectual value in studying English, which I loved. Like, I'm really interested in literature as well, but the reasons behind that were, like, you know, in line with what you were talking about in English culture, and not, yeah, kind of a snobbery around image making, I guess.
It's interesting in academia as well. I've come across a few times a distrust of imagery, even in areas where you would think that imagery would be important. So I heard somebody talking who was like a Roman scholar who was looking at Roman figurines, and she said many of the academics in the field didn't think it was a good course to follow to actually write about existing artifacts that she could describe and put images of in the book. They wanted, as evidence of certain things that she was looking at, they wanted written evidence. The actual visual evidence wasn't good enough. So I think that maybe says something. And I don't think they were British. So maybe academia as a whole is like a kind of Britishness, you know, this cloud of Britishness that's messing everything up. Above everything.
Sorry, Kathy. I was thinking, I find it frustrating when I have to apply for like grants, which I don't do because I'm dyslexic and I feel like my words can't express as much as my images can, and I can't always find the words to talk about it. And it's like, unless you have the two, like, things are cut off to you.
Yeah, there needs to be more coming together of the two. I feel words and images. I guess that I have grown up a lot looking at fashion magazines and the idea of a fashion story. So, you know, it's a visual story in I don't know, 10 pages or something, which is just visual images with maybe just a line of text here or there to kind of guide you. And I love that kind of idea. And it's very loose and very open to interpretation. So yeah, maybe people just aren't image literate enough or something, and that's a problem.
Well, yeah, because it's a language, isn't it, as well? It's like, yeah, it's a language you can learn, and if people were taught in schools, like if art was taught in the same way that other subjects are, it wouldn't be like, you know, this thing that's only for certain people anymore. It would just be like another language that everyone has access to.
And it's ironic that we now live in an age where there's more accessibility to creating images, and we're surrounded by more. It's a very image heavy led kind of culture. But I think you're right. I feel like often people aren't equipped necessarily to engage with that, particularly kind of on a, I say on a critical sense, but in the way that just gives them kind of agency to really think about the power of images and how they might the creative potential of.
So maybe they're making. Distrustful. They're distrustful of the imagery. That's maybe the problem with not having more focus on it in education. I was interested in what you said about secondary schools and art. Do you have a particular experience of how art is not taught well in secondary schools, or just your general observation?
I think it's just simply not being taught at all. And you know, that's, for me, that's the really shocking thing, is that we've moved from a situation, and I'm always a little bit aware that I'm beginning to sound like a grumpy old man in my middle age. You know, it was much better in the 90s, you know, when, you know, it was kind of like, but by this I mean, you know, I think the problem I have at the moment now is that there's a huge disparity in experiences. So whereas I think, you know, there was a kind of curriculum where, you know, arts provision was part of that, it wasn't always great, wasn't particularly well funded or supported, but there was a sense in which, you know, if you're in Macclesfield, or, you know, if you're in Lewisham, or if you're in Totnes, you were sort of doing the same sort of thing, following the same sort of curriculum, and there was a kind of consistency. Whereas now, you know, I go to schools that have like beautiful galleries, they're specialist arts and design schools, and they have state schools, I mean comprehensives, not private, but, you know, and they'd have, you know, they might have 7 art teachers because they're a specialist academy, and really great access to contemporary art. And they, you know, you're talking to 16 and 17 year olds who are very literate. And then you might go to another school, even just a few miles away, where they might do one of either music, drama or art every 2 weeks. You know, so yeah, that for me is really problematic, is that sense in which there are sort of these, you know, cultural deserts within the kind of school landscape where, you know, access to the arts is really, really meagre and has been allowed to kind of just wither on the vine. And you know, and you know, the one thing that is consistent, and again, this is me getting on my high horse, is that they're not cutting art, music and drama in private schools and independent schools.
Yeah, and that says, you know, something, doesn't it? Yeah. Yeah, that's really interesting. And the art room always has been the kind of place where you can, like some kind of refuge, I feel, in schools, where if you don't really fit in other things, it was a place, wasn't it, for kids to find something that they could do and enjoy doing. So that's particularly terrible. Okay, I guess we're getting towards the end of our time now, really, and I'd like to finish up by asking you both about what you're doing right now, what you're working on, or what have you got coming up. Harold, could I ask you first?
Sure. I'm about to launch a much delayed project with the Welcome Collection, which is opening in July. Yes.
Amazing. This is the dance. Yeah.
Well, I should just explain, the whole work is looking at this idea of how happiness as an emotion has been marked in various cultures. There are two exhibitions called Joy and Tranquility. I'm in the joy section, and I've been looking at social dance phenomena where groups of people over time have kind of gathered and, in a kind of sort of rave-like form, danced in reaction to kind of societal trauma or oppression. So that coming together of people in movement to somehow deal with and process, whether that's kind of like, the Black Death, or whether that's economic depression in the 30s, or the onset of HIV AIDS in the 90s. So yeah, it's kind of exploring that phenomenon.
And so that has been delayed, you say? That was
It was meant to open last March, I think, but right. I mean, like a lot of things, but yeah, it's going to open in July, fingers
cool.
crossed.
That sounds great. And Rhiannon, have you got something that you're engaged with right now?
I'm working on a body of work that will be my next solo show, but also because this year has been so unusual in so many ways, it's given me a space to kind of create a bit of privacy around a body of work that I'm trying to make in the opposite way of how I've made work to date. So I'm kind of reversing my process and going backwards with it and coming away from actually like image as source material and connecting with something a lot more intuitive. So I'm really enjoying like the freedom of a private studio and like time away from like kind of the Instagram gaze or whatever of this constant output, and just reconnecting and reassessing what my values are. But I have also got work at the moment in the Saatchi Gallery in a group show called Antisocial Isolation that's been put on by Delphian Gallery, and that's running this month.
And when is that? When is that on until?
I think that's on until mid June.
Okay.
What about Guadalajara?
Guadalajara, as I
actually, I am putting a proposal together for a piece with an artist from Guadalajara who I met out there, and we're trying to collaborate at the moment, kind of looking into the colour pink and. What that means for both our cultures. So hopefully that will be a project soon too.
And a residency there, so.
I've done the residency. This is someone I met on the residency. Okay. We're doing a project together now.
That sounds great. Well, thank you both so much. It's been really great to talk to you and hear your thoughts on this subject. See you soon. Bye-bye.
Thanks.
Bye. Thank you.
Bye. Bye.
Out of Space is a podcast series produced by Space, London's largest artist studios provider. To learn more about the artists taking part and for further resources, please visit the What's On section of Space's website at www.spacestudios.org.